Hello, my name is Olivia Harding, and I am the host of Folk Files, a podcast that explores the tangled history of folk songs. Every month, I choose a topic to dive into for about 20 to 30 minutes. The subject of each episode could be a song. In the case of Shady Grove, a lot of people believe that it is a later version of the English folk song Matty Groves, but it's not that simple. A general topic. The main theme that I saw while researching folk songs about birds from all over the world is that many of them include nonsense syllables meant to represent the bird songs. Or a question that I want to answer. There has never been any real question that Black people were central to the development of this musical style. So why do we still picture white men hauling on the rope when we think of sea shanties? Press play and join me on a journey through the origins of murder ballads, sea shanties, rebel songs, and other music that has withstood the test of time. Folk Files is so pleased to be the newest show to join the BGS Podcast Network. Find us at thebluegrasssituation.com or where you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Chiefs on Broadway. There's a different way to experience live music in Nashville. Eric Church's Chiefs on Broadway is home to the Neon Steeple, an intimate live music venue in the heart of downtown Nashville, where artists and songwriters take the stage for up-close, unforgettable shows. From stripped-down sets to surprise guests, no two nights are the same. Check out the Neon Steeple lineup and get your tickets now at chiefsonbroadway.com.
Hi, and welcome to The Working Songwriter, the show where today's best songwriters come to talk shop. I'm your host, Joe Pug. Each episode here, we host a distinguished guest, and we ask them to go deep on their inspiration, on their process, on the general ups and downs of making a life in music. So, whether you're a grizzled veteran selling cameos for $50 a piece to cover the insurance on your rehearsal space, or else a scrappy upstart, rehearsing in your uncle's garage, even though he's a borderline hoarder. This is your show, because ultimately, it is what every writer seeks most, an ironclad excuse to put off actually writing. Hey everyone, it's the last Friday of June 2026, and I thank you for joining us. This week's show is brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built by musicians and for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform to build a beautiful website for your music. I'm old enough to remember when you had to pay somebody called a web developer to get a website made. It would always be some guy named Jocko who drove a Hummer H2 with one of those stereo systems that took up the whole trunk and who was always trying to sell you vials of human growth hormone so that you could dominate your local YMCA pickup basketball game. And old Jocko would charge you about $1,000 for a website that would be obsolete in 6 months. But it's the future now, you guys. That's not how it works anymore. We're allowed to have nice things now. One of those nice things is Bandzoogle. For over 20 years, Bandzoogle has made it easy to build a stunning website and online store for your music. Now they've added a brand new EPK plan so that musicians can create a professional single-page electronic press kit in minutes. Everything you need is already built in. Music players, images, text bio, video embeds, a gig calendar, press quotes, and access to Bandzoogle's award-winning support team 7 days a week. The new EPK plan starts at just $6.95 per month, and the Working Songwriter podcast listeners can go to bandzoogle.com to try it for free for 30 days. Use the promo code TWSEPK to get 10% off the first year of any new EPK plan subscription. That's bandzoogle.com, promo code TWSEPK when you sign up for a new EPK plan. Finally, if you enjoy this podcast, if you'd like to help it remain a viable endeavor for me, here's a couple things that you could do to help. First and foremost, you could become a subscriber to The Vault. What is The Vault? The Vault is a private, members-only section of my website that hosts every single episode of The Working Songwriter ever recorded. Currently, only the latest 100 episodes are available in iTunes and Spotify for free. All of the previous episodes are available there in the vault for streaming and for download. Additionally, the Vault has every single album I've ever recorded for streaming and download, and it also has an archive of the Enthusiast Digest newsletter there. Go to joepugmusic.com/vault, become a subscriber today. It's about the price of a nice cup of coffee every month, and for your generosity, you'll also receive access to all of that content. If you're not in a place where you can contribute in that way, I totally understand. You could still help us out in a couple of ways that were free. First, you could leave us a rating in the iTunes store, or second, you could simply tell a friend about the show. Spread the word about the show. The simple math on those two things is that they will help me much more than they will be a pain in the ass for you. Okay, I'll end all the harassment there. I hope that you enjoy this week's episode. This week, we're thrilled to step out of our normal comfort zone by welcoming one of our country's most acclaimed young novelists. Originally from Mount Vernon, Ohio, author Stephen Markley now makes his home in Los Angeles, California. He attended undergraduate at Miami of Ohio before being accepted into the prestigious Iowa Writers Workshop. Simon & Schuster published his debut novel, Ohio, in 2018. The book was widely praised for its unflinching portrait of post-9/11 Rust Belt America. Then in 2023, he returned with the massively popular novel, The Deluge, a work of fiction about climate change that the New York Times named as one of its notable books. He also works as a screenwriter in Los Angeles, as a member of the writer's room for the Hulu comedy series, Only Murders in the Building, starring Martin Short and Steve Martin. The New York Times Book Review said that The Deluge shows the range of its author's gifts: polyphonic narration, silken sentences, and elaborate world building. And none other than Stephen King said of the same book that it is, simply put, a modern classic. If you read it, you'll never forget it. He also named it as the favorite book he had read that year. What a thrill it is to welcome onto our show such a profoundly talented artist who falls outside our normal realm of expertise. I think there's a lot for songwriters to learn on this cross-discipline episode of The Working Songwriter. Stephen Markley, what a treat to have you on The Working Songwriter podcast, kind of a cross-disciplinary, creative podcast today. You grew up in Mount Vernon, Ohio, which I think many of your readers could be forgiven for thinking that your upbringing was a lot like a place like New Canaan in your book, Ohio. Did you use a lot of license there, or was your life growing up there pretty similar to what we might have read in that book?
I don't think anything I ever write is a one-to-one, so certainly New Canaan was influenced by growing up in Mount Vernon, but you know, also it's an imaginary place that where you need sort of the different attributes of several different Ohio towns. So you need to stretch out and bring in some of the surrounding area, some of the surrounding lore, I guess is the word. I think every author in their first their first works is trying to explicate the place they're from. And think about what it means to them. And certainly that was, part of the project of Ohio.
So were you a creative kid? Was there any inkling? I mean, because when you're a kid, it's like astronaut, play on the Indians, firefighter. Sure. Novelist really isn't on the cue card there of what you could choose from. Were there any early kind of creative inklings that this might have been the path that you'd go?
No, I think I have wanted to be a novelist since I was 5 years old.
What?
I mean, yeah, it's true. I mean, I wanted to be an NBA basketball player first, but my limitations physically and on the court sort of precluded that. No,
well,
the
Cavs were so bad in the late 90s, too. So
we had the Price Doherty era that seemed promising until Jordan came in and wrecked it. I grew up just loving to read. I've been lucky enough to get blurbed by the master himself, Stephen King. But when I was a kid, I would read his novels. I'd stay up till 2-3 in the morning, just tearing through The Shining, Gerald's Game, Pet Sematary.
Really?
Just could not get enough of that stuff. So it leads to a twisted, adulthood, of course. But I was just like such a reader. And I always thought that, what a magic trick it was to be able to like wrap someone up in a story like that.
Okay, well, you've kind of given me an inkling. I've been trying to get my 9-year-old to read like crazy, but I think I've been giving him stuff that's too dated. And I'd never thought, even though the subject matter is a little bit dark, I'd never thought about Stephen King as the gateway drug.
The gateway, but yes.
Now that you mention it, I mean, his stuff reads so beautifully. It's so fun and so deep at the same time. I can see how that would have worked for a kid.
Oh, totally. And I mean, I was in the perfect pocket of like the Jurassic Park era. So, when I picked up Jurassic Park in third grade, I was just like, well, this is a masterpiece, clearly. Let's move on to Sphere and Congo and the other, literary classics of Michael Crichton. So,
yeah,
it was just like those simple ways into wanting to be a storyteller. And then eventually you learn there are other authors who write about things other than dinosaurs and killer clowns.
Sure. But it would be kind of auspicious. Like that really was a time when you could have like a national bestseller of a book and then it would scale into culture in a totally different way that you don't see that many books doing anymore. I feel like all modern books are like kind of like therapeutic language dumps now.
Yeah, sure.
But it's really auspicious that you would have come of age at that time because it just had to seem huge to you the way that these things would explode into culture.
Sure. And I mean, I think for me, like it's for any like person trying to do a creative field, an artistic field, you start out like trying to do these pale imitations of it. So, when I was a kid, I was writing this series of books. It was called Ticks. It was about giant mutant ticks, that had like eaten nuclear waste and had become, a problem that, the military had to deal with. And I look back at that stuff and it's so funny because you can sort of see the themes of like the books I'd write as an adult, like buried in, my third grade Ticks saga.
Yeah. And you wouldn't know that it would be the theme of climate change because at the time what we were all worried about was acid rain. We were really into the acid rain in the 1990s. So, not only did you want to be a novelist from age 5, but it sounds like you were even attempting it like from a very young age. That's very unusual.
Yeah, I mean, it was just the way I grew up. So I'm not, it's just how I played, how I had fun. I mean, like outwardly, I was like a very sort of normal, again, loved playing basketball, like would spend hours and hours at the local gym or gyms, like wherever I could find to play with my friends. And then, at night, like get into a book and get into, trying to like figure out by myself how the construction of a story worked and how, over time you sort of like grow this instinct for it like anything else.
How much of that, did a certain amount of that just have to grow out of boredom? I kind of can't imagine. I mean, my kids don't have any devices, but like, A lot of kids are just buried in devices, and if you'd had the iPad, I'm thinking that you're playing on that instead of trying to write Ticks,
For sure. I mean, my parents didn't let me have video games as a kid until about seventh grade. Then Mario Kart came along and sort of, you had to have it or, you're calling child social services. I once heard a songwriter say to me that she was like so mad at like the social media era basically because it sort of stopped her from being bored. And that was how she would write songs, is she'd get a tune in her head when she was bored and sort of like take it, think about it over and over again. And I think like it's so important for kids to get bored and have to like resort to their imaginations to facilitate, something fun happening, something interesting happening. And I think like to this day, like I remain like a very imaginative person. Like when my mind wanders, it's usually into telling myself a story.
Really?
Huh. Yeah.
It's like the default. So when did you decide, I mean, obviously you had this burning within you, but a lot of kids have dreams and then life gets real, man.
Totally.
Did you know when you went to Miami that that's you were going to Miami to do that, or was it more at first like, well, I'm going to get the old marketing degree here and here go?
Yeah, no, I was in this weird place because sort of going to college, I never really said out loud like I want to be a writer, but it was certainly what I had burning inside of me. And so the first big leap was, you know, I my sophomore year, I took a creative writing class. And my professor at the time, this guy, Stephen Bauer, sort of read the first story I submitted and wrote me this letter saying, like, did you plagiarize this? Like, you know, this is, wow, you know, remarkable and good enough to get you into a well-rated MFA program. And I still have that letter somewhere. But it was the first time like anybody had ever sort of looked at me and said like, yeah, like you have something. And I think for any young person, those small moments are so important, you know, just those little indicators that like those little, sort of, you know, the ligature that lets you get to the next step. It's so vital. And so, you know, after that, I was like, okay, like this, you know, this is what you want to do. And then you have to figure out how to do it, which is obviously the gulf between those two things is enormous. And I spent, you know, probably the next 20 years trying to figure that part out.
Yeah. But like you said, I mean, that could have been a real fork in the road there. I mean, you need a small amount. And that doesn't sound like it was a small amount of encouragement. That's an enormous amount of encouragement to get from a professor, to get accused of plagiarism in a pre-ChatGPT era. I mean, you really had to, you really had to go for it.
Yeah. I mean, he went looking for it, I'm pretty sure, online. And I was like, no, this is just like, this is the thing I came up with in my head.
This is. So, you would then obviously, you would go to probably the most prestigious, MFA program for this, for like literary fiction, with the Iowa Writers Workshop, home of Carver, home of all the rest. And what did you have to, like, when you got there, did you find yourself able to swim immediately, or were you like, damn, man, I got to get up to speed here. There's a lot of stuff I got to learn.
Yeah, well, I was coming at it from a different place. And I think this was so important, was I was 30 when I got there. Mm-hmm. You know, I had sort of lived a life in Chicago, which incidentally is where I discovered Joe Pug. But I'd had this time in my life of trying to be a freelance writer and failing at it and being broke and being like, oh my God, what am I doing? And so to me, getting into Iowa was mostly a relief because they were, you know, we were getting paid to teach a class, of undergrads for like $13,000 a year. Yeah. And to me, that was like, oh God, like health insurance and a paycheck. Like, this is so nice. I was just so grateful for that part of it. But I, because I'd been working at it on my own for so long, when I got there, it was not intimidating. It was more that like I was prepared for it mentally. Yeah. And certainly, like, I was in a class of some all-stars, people who were getting book contracts, like, the second week they showed up on campus. Wow. And it didn't quite happen that quickly for me, but I think, like, what I learned in that era of failure was, you know, what a coach, the sports coach calls a stick-to-itiveness, right? Like, a sense of, like, you're going to have setbacks and you just have to, like, be the goldfish and forget the setback and keep swimming.
You mean creative or professional setbacks?
Professional. I mean, the thing about like writing a like literature, writing novels, is that it's not a young person's form. You know, I look back at the stuff I was working on in my early 20s, and I'm like mortified by it, right? And it's just one of those fields that requires a little more seasoning to get it to work. And so, you know, I think like Iowa came along in my life at exactly the right time. And certainly people have different experiences there. Not everybody has the time of their life. But for me, it was exactly the right place with exactly the right people at exactly the right moment. And the friends I made there and the professors I had were so instrumental just in sort of teaching me how to become a professional writer.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny that you would say it's not a young person's form, because I've always noticed that with novelists and reading their works, because you can often see someone in their mid-20s whose facility with writing completely outstrips their life experience by 100%. Leaps and bounds. Because I mean, there's just a certain amount of having been around people and, you know, how you thought life works versus seeing it IRL and experiencing it on the ground, that sometimes people can just be so phenomenal on the page, but just so it does not ring true at all to anybody, because it's not, they haven't lived enough life to know that it's not true.
I couldn't agree more. And it's such a strange thing because obviously you can't quite teach life experience. Like you can't like say, hey, go do this set of things and you'll be seasoned. You'll be ready. But yeah, I mean, Iowa, especially there were so many people there who could write the fuck out of a sentence. Like you were just, yeah. I was always like blown away by some of the people, some writing there. And then, you'd get to from the sentence to the story and you wouldn't quite find anything in it.
Right.
It was 20 pages of beautiful sentences strung together. But you were sort of left scratching your head about it. And that to me is always like, I don't think I'm the greatest sentence writer in the world, but certainly like when I can spin a yarn. And that was what I had going in that I feel like I was really, sort of could focus my energies on was like, here's what you're good at. Now how do you take that to the next level and complete like a fully realized novel, that has that sort of that Stephen King yarn spinning feel to it, but also is, you know, saying something big about the world.
Is this the point when you were there or did this develop earlier? One of the hallmarks of your style is fragmented is not the right word. It's like you will take many different perspectives and many different characters and write like that. And it's very much you. I'm sure other people have done it as well, but I kind of recognize it as your type of writing. When did you start to develop that voice? And was it something that you always had, or was that something that you would learn through technique?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was probably always a method that intrigued me. Like I love that polyphonic book where you're getting, you're seeing this series of events from multiple characters' perspectives and therefore learning about it in this entirely fresh way every time you encounter it. I, you know, didn't set out to write that way. I didn't intend to. It was just kind of the way that novel developed. And then when I moved on to The Deluge, that was sort of what I had in mind. And something to me is just so interesting about seeing a set of events from different people's perspectives. Like I love the process of trying to step into another person's shoes, think about the world from their perspective, even if it's a perspective that I disagree with or that horrifies me or that, you know, makes me uncomfortable. You know, to me, that is like the sort of the highest bar that you can clear, is getting people to go along for the ride in a character who is certainly not yourself.
Yeah, it's cool to see that style and that voice developing you there, because sometimes people, when they have, I'm thinking of, you know, you start with Ohio and then into The Deluge. If you have success with something, sometimes people, for example, like my son, I'm teaching him how to pitch. He loves pitching. He's getting very mm-hmm. good at it.
Yes.
He can throw the crap out of a four-seam fastball. That's his pitch. It just works for whatever reason. But of course, he never wants to throw it. He wants to throw all these other new things that he's learning, and he just won't throw the damn pitch that works every time. And I just love it when I find artists that, not that they aren't trying other things, but in general, they know what their four-seam fastball is, and they're not
yes.
afraid to throw it when you need to get an out at the end of the inning. You know what
yes.
I mean?
Totally.
If you're up by eight, please try the splitter. Please try the...
Yes.
So, right. You know, it's a very welcoming thing to see in an artist. And as a reader, you're happy to see that person do what they do, you know?
Totally. I mean, to me, experimentation is kind of... it's necessary to keep it fresh. Like, certainly after Ohio... The only thing my editor and Simon & Schuster wanted was like another sort of Rust Belt noir mystery type
right.
book. And I was like, hey, actually the next thing I want to write is this 1,000-page near future climate crisis epic. And there was a lot of skepticism at that. Like that is not typically what a debut author who has some success goes out and does or should do. But it's just like, that's the book I had in my head and that's the one like I had to write. And certainly the challenge of it was so much more immense than Ohio. That to me, it's like, this is the point. This is why we do this is to find that next mountain to clear. And it certainly keeps me like interested and fascinated by the form. And it's sort of why I've like, you know, come out to Hollywood and tried my hand at screenwriting is it's this other challenge entirely.
Yeah.
And certainly I've had my frustrations out here, but at the same time, it's like, man, if I could just like get to that next level and get to that place where I'm like the person concocting the show rather than serving as sort of the socket wrench, that would be amazing. So
there had to be times though during the deluge, because that book, I mean, it had to be an insane amount of research. And so there had to be times as you were writing it or in the middle of doing that research where you were like, damn, if I was just writing about New Canaan, I know where the IGA market is. I don't have to research that. You know? Did you ever second guess your, cause I mean, it's a tome, it's an immense book. It's 900 pages. There's a lot of like just technical, like brute force technical research that had to go into it. Did you ever second guess yourself as you were going through that process?
I think there was a moment, probably two moments, like, because I started Ohio and the Deluge at the same time around 2010.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yes. And so then I set aside the Deluge to finish Ohio. That was around 2015, 2016. So I didn't return to it for another 2.5 years, 3 years.
Okay.
So when I picked it back up and I was like, okay, this is the next book, this is what I'm doing, I had 40% of it done, but obviously it's just this sprawling mess, already too long, already too complex, too involved. And so there was this moment of like, all right, now I have to make this work. And sort of like a let's reset, let's think about the novel in its entirety, what it's going to feel like, what it's going to look like, and sort of starting over with a fresh set of eyes. Then there was the point where after I turned in the first draft, which was 1,500 pages, and COVID had just started, and I was trying to like start my first round of edits. My editor's like, we've got to cut this book by a third. And oh yeah, the world's on fire. And like trying to sort of mentally focus during 2020 when everything's popping off on cutting 600 pages from this incredibly complex novel. That was like a mental hurdle to clear for sure.
Did probably have to, on a certain level, it must feel better to have to cut 600 pages than write another 600 more. That's how I would feel, but how
totally
did you feel about that?
I mean, every writer has their own sort of like, you know, their own sort of devil that's chasing them the whole time. And mine has always been like, I have those writer friends where the blank page is the problem, like just getting up and getting started. Yeah. My problem is like, I run out of blank pages that are acceptable. It's more, I pump stuff out. And then I have to sort of carve it out of that huge block of marble.
Right.
Yeah, so I'm always chiseling away.
I love the idea that you showed up at the publisher and you're like, well, not only is it a subject that has nothing to do with my past success, but also it's 1,500 pages.
Yeah, like, exactly.
My dad's buddies used to have a construction company, and their literal slogan on the t-shirts was, we're slow, but we're expensive.
Yeah.
So,
I love that.
What better poet to pair Stephen's interview with than another alumnus of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, Philip Levine? Both writers are able to conjure the industrial American Midwest with simple, clear prose that reveals truths that are much more complex. And there's a poem that embodies that by Levine entitled The Simple Truth. I bought $1.50's worth of small red potatoes, took them home, boiled them in their jackets, and ate them for dinner with a little butter and salt. Then I walked through the dried fields on the edge of town. In middle June, the light hung on in the dark furrows at my feet, and in the mountain oaks overhead, the birds were gathering for the night, the jays and mockers squawking back and forth, the finches still darting into the dusty light. The woman who sold me the potatoes was from Poland. She was someone out of my childhood in a pink spangled sweater and sunglasses, praising the perfection of all her fruits and vegetables at the roadside stand, and urging me to taste even the pale, raw, sweet corn trucked all the way, she swore, from New Jersey. Eat, eat, she said. Even if you don't, I'll say you did. Some things you know all your life. They are so simple and true, they must be said without elegance, meter, and rhyme. They must be laid on the table beside the salt shaker, the glass of water, the absence of light gathering in the shadows of picture frames.
They must be naked and alone. They must stand for themselves. My friend Henry and I arrived at this together in 1965, before I went away, before he began to kill himself and the two of us to betray our love. Can you taste what I'm saying? It is onions or potatoes, a pinch of simple salt, the wealth of melting butter. It is obvious. It stays in the back of your throat like a truth you never uttered because the time was always wrong. It stays there for the rest of your life, unspoken. Made of that dirt we call earth, that metal we call salt, in a form we have no other words for. And you live on it.
When did the move out to LA and the screenwriting start to creep into this? Because in some ways, I think like, damn, man, you got it, mate. You got, you know, these two novels that have come out in the last decade that have began to work their way into the culture. Like, you could just move into the woods and write books. You could move up to Maine with Stephen King and just write books in Maine. Like, what drew you out to Los Angeles and particularly like almost a different medium to write in?
Yeah, I mean, first off, the dirty secret of literary writing, the literary field, is that it doesn't pay very well. And, you know, like, what's that Oscar Wilde quote that, like, you know, amateurs talk about art, real artists talk about money. And that's kind of like when you get to be a successful novelist. And I mean, I am in, like, you know, probably the 1% of what people get paid for a novel now, a literary novel at least. But it's just not enough to actually like make a living full time. You know, it takes 5 years minimum to write a novel, you know,
right? Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you split up that advance over enough time and you're suddenly like, you know, not breaking even. And so you end up teaching, or in, you know, a lot of our cases, I think for my generation, you go out to Hollywood and try to see what will happen there. And the way it happened for me was I was at Iowa and David Milch came to give a talk. He was a former graduate. David Milch did NYPD Blue, Deadwood for listeners who don't know. So like a real like legend of television writing and someone who kind of pushed the form.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So he sort of said to everybody, like, if anybody has a script they want me to read, I'd be happy to. I had written this script like 2 years earlier and just sort of like tossed it in a drawer and forgotten about it. I had been in Chicago just sort of, you know, I was like, I'm going to try this form. I'm going to get this free software and see what comes out. And so that is the script I gave him. And, you know, so he called me into an office in Iowa and sort of said, this is great. Would you like help getting an agent in LA? And my response was, yes, David Milch, creator of NYPD Blue and Deadwood.
Sure.
I would love your help getting an agent.
I'm going to shop around, David. Hold on.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And from there, you know, I sort of, you know, I got this agent at CAA, Tony Etz, who recently passed away, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I sort of was still nervous about it. And he wrote me an email that I printed out after his death, and I still have it. And it just sort of says, like, look, if you have a couple agencies after you, you should probably find a way to pay your way out here and figure it out from there. To that effect. And that's what I did. You know, I had a yard sale at Iowa, and I sold off some stuff and packed up my car and drove to Los Angeles, got a roommate to come with me, and, you know, sort of like hacked it out here for a few years until Ohio came out.
It's got to be a much different writing style than the novelist thing. Maybe I can draw an analog here. I've been writing my own records for years, and in the last year, for similar reasons, if real artists talk about money, I've thought a lot more about writing for more, you know, commercial, larger artists. So I've been going out to Nashville to write, and I wonder if your experience was the same. I'd never written with other people before, and it's a much different form. Like, this is a deal where you come into a room, you have a morning write and afternoon write, and you have 4 hours to write a song, and you're working together, and it's by hook or by crook. And everyone's moving fast, man. I can't believe how fast these people move. And it really kind of made the speed is what really made my head spin at first. What did that feel like to go out and write what I'm assuming was more collaboratively at that point?
Yeah, I mean, that's something I'm still learning. You know, being in a writer's room is such a different experience. Like, when I was coming from the world of novel writing where it's just you and you have to produce the entire piece before anybody's supposed to read it, really different. And obviously, it you know, like you develop great skills as a writer, but you also develop a certain stubbornness and a certain like clarity of vision. And clarity of vision is not always helpful when you're sitting in a room with eight other people who are also smart and also have good ideas. And so really adjusting to that that collaborative element has been a learning curve for me. I think it's one of those things where I will be learning about this for as long as I stick with it. And maybe, you know, I'm reading this book about F. Scott Fitzgerald coming out to Hollywood and drinking himself to death. So, like, I want to avoid that.
Don't do that.
I want to get out before that happens. It's one of those things where, like, oh, I get it. Like, this is a very frustrating industry.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like it, but it's also very alluring. I've been on a creative streak of my own recently, and I think it was kind of spurred from being in those rooms with those guys and those gals, just to see people working at that level. It's funny, the best piece of advice I got so far from one of those rooms, I'd finished one of the first writes. There's an older dude in it who I could tell was very experienced, and I walked out. I said, you know, that was one of my first ones. Thanks so much for having me. I was kind of the scrub. I just point blank, I was like, got any advice for me? I'm just starting this out, man. Like, what do I need to know? And instead of giving me like some kind of mushy, you know, go get him kid, he was like, yeah, I got a very specific piece of advice for you. I'm like, great, give it to me. And he was like, if you're in a room and there's someone rolling or a group of people rolling and you're not among that group, that's totally fine. Just stay the fuck out of the way. Just get out of the way, and that's fine, because we all have a day where it's not us, and the worst possible thing you can do is try to muscle your way into the role that someone else is on, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, I imagine, though, that songwriting, I forget who said the thing about, like, any technology sufficiently advanced, it feels like magic, but to me, like, that's still what, like, song, like, writing a song feels like. Like, I don't understand how people do it. It just seems like this, like, absolute, like, creative miracle. Whereas, like, with fiction writing or constructing a story, let's say, like, even a great novel, like, I can sort of look at the engine and the engine's all the same, right? Like, it looks the same as the engine because it's the field I've come up in, and I'm you know, I've developed the eye for it. So I can at least, like, look and see what they're doing. And to me, like, being in a writer's room, why that's so different is because it's everybody trying to build an engine together without, you know, and everybody has a different idea of what eventually it will look like. And that's the part that is so, I think, sometimes vexing, but also can be incredibly fun. And certainly I've never laughed harder than hanging out with some of these folks, just sort of bullshitting, spitting off ideas.
Yeah, it's funny. The hit rate is different. I feel like the hit rate is a little bit lower when I'm writing, like the batting average is a lot lower, but the maybe it's the way analytics have driven baseball, lower batting averages. But man, when it is hit, a lot of home runs too. Like I've seen it happen in a room with people who are really good, obviously spin up something that was so much more than the sum of its parts, so much more than what the original person's idea would have been. And it gets kind of intoxicating to be around that.
Totally. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And it beats a real job. I'll say that.
Oh, buddy, we both had them, and man,
never go back. Yeah,
I gotta remind myself of that sometimes. Like, I'd say the worst part about a real job, and the reason that I'll continue to hang my own shingle, because I mean, like you were just mentioning, like, all right, so let's say, you know, full time novelist, even if you're at the very, very tippy top of what people are getting paid now, considering the time in, it's still a hard way to make a living.
Yeah,
same way being kind of like an independent musician. It's very hard to scratch out a living with it. And oh my God, I was about to make a wonderful point then. I've just found that it's okay to think about that money end of it. And it's led me to, like, for example, it led me to this podcast. I thought that this would be a great way to do it. And now it's led me to so many different connections with friends and people over the years.
That's what nobody ever tells you when you're starting out, right? It's like you sort of you figure out the creative part of it if you're passionate enough, but nobody like sits you down and explains, like, you're going to have to know how to have health insurance at some point. You're going to have to, like, know how to, like, string together. And at first I was so bad at that part, like stringing together the paychecks to stay sustained. And I think that's the real, that's another learning curve that when you're young, you don't care much about, but it turns out to be like one of the most vital elements of the creative life.
Yes. Yes. And I do find like, so my wife has always been, what do you call it? A W-9 employee where they just take the taxes out. And so when she looks, when we got married, we started doing our taxes together and right. she was like, what do you do for a living? Right. But I find it's made me much more, it was a hard learning curve, like you mentioned, but now that I'm kind of on the other side of it, I'm just very conscious of what everything looks like financially in the next quarter, the next two quarters, the next year, the next 2 years. And it actually puts me at ease a little bit because if I see something soft money-wise or if I see a big expense coming up, I see it really far in advance and I can really buffer for it. Whereas if you're just getting the paycheck, health insurance comes out, 401k comes out, taxes come out, you can just kind of not think about it.
Listen, I was seeing this musician in LA once and he told this story about how he wrote a song for his wife and the whole crowd went, aw, and then he goes, well, it's not that kind of song. It's called I Don't Work at a Bank. And I was laughing so hard because I was like, that's exactly right. Like, this is exactly what it feels like to.
Man, yeah. This is a funny creative thing, and maybe this happens on your end with the writing of stories as well, but that would be a song where, like, I was in a writing mode for an album, so I was writing by myself every day very intensely, very serious songs. Sure. And I remember I was talking to my manager at the time. It was a Saturday morning. And I called him up very early on a Saturday morning because I had some shit I had to figure out for a show coming up. And he's like, man, you called me on a Saturday. And I was like, well, dude, we don't work in a bank. Like, come on, we're in show business here. And then that morning, I wrote that song in in 10 minutes I wrote it. And I thought it was kind of stupid. And then I started playing it at shows. And it's been like the most notable song I've written in the last decade, probably, you know? So, you know, you just never know when things, I don't know. Often it's the things that you work on that you don't expect to be anything that somehow you give creative life to because you're not expecting them to be anything.
For sure. I mean, I think that's why, like, my next book is a collection of short stories, and that's why I wanted to do that, so I could regain a little more spontaneity, because with a novel you really have to, like, you know, you're just planning for a decade, you know, like, that's it takes such an enormous amount of sort of like really regimented figuring out of the actual plot and how it's all going to work together. And so I really wanted to regain a little of that spontaneity. And so some of the stories in the novel are just like, well, here's a really crazy idea that I'm going to pump out in like a week. That's crazy. But we'll stick it in there and see how people react.
Yeah. Sometimes we'll use the phrase in songwriting of just driving the bus into the wall of like, let's not plan too much and we'll just drive the bus. It strikes me that it's literally impossible to write a novel by driving the bus into the wall. Like, it could not exist without an underlying structure beforehand, almost.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure people have tried. I'm sure there's, you know, some, stream of consciousness, 100-page, 50,000-word novel that exists out there. But the problem is that, like, that form starts to... it just starts to feel so sloppy. You're not sure what you're reading at some point. And yeah. You need the structure. You need that sense of, when I used to teach, I'd tell my students, this is still the same form as like when caveman sat around the campfire and said, once upon a time, I've got a story to tell you, et cetera, et cetera. Like, you want people leaning in and you want them to get to the conclusion and have that sensation of like, oh man, that journey was worth it. Like, everything that came before was leading to that moment. And if you can't create that feeling, it can sometimes feel, very, like a big letdown, I guess.
Totally. You know what's been really helpful for me? I noticed 3 or 4 years ago, like if we're having a party at my house, kids are playing in the basement, the adults are upstairs having adult beverages. And if I'm going to tell a story at a party, whether it's about something my kid did at baseball practice or whether it was something that happened to me on the road, I just naturally tell... in conversation, I'll tell a story in a way like you're just talking about right then, which has like kind of a hook at the start that gets you kind of interested and then has some sort of payoff at the end that we can all feel it going towards. Obviously, you don't succeed at that every story you tell at a party. But I've been bringing that to my work, my creative work, so much more of like if I was at a party, I'm writing a song here, but if I was at a party right now and I wanted to tell people what happened in the song, how would I do it?
Absolutely. And sometimes I'll be in conversation. This is like, a clear demonstration of what a sociopath I am. But I'll be in a conversation at a party listening to someone's story, and I'll be like, all right, you got to cut that. You got to cut that. You've got to get to this end, that little hook. That's what you want to get people to. Not, I won't say that out loud, but it'll be running through my head. I'm never going to get invited to your party now.
It's more Shaggy Dog stories than it's not.
Exactly.
That's for sure.
So well, we need what people to get literature degrees. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
What does your day-to-day then look like? Are you like 9 to 5 in a writer's room most of the time for like the quote-unquote day job of writing for TV, and then you're doing the novel stuff on the side? Are you bifurcating your days? Is it seasons of writing for TV? What does your creative day look like usually?
Yeah, now that is, you know, we do 20 weeks in the writer's room. So that's like a nice amount of time to sort of have fun with your friends, get a bunch of ideas out, hopefully write something cool. And in that case, I'll get up early and sort of do my novel writing, my literary writing in the morning. But I've been off for the summer, which is, you know, magnificent. And it's really like, I feel like I've almost like, you know, robbed a bank in terms of I am living exactly the life I've always wanted, which is I get up, I drink my coffee, I write for, you know, 2 hours, 3 hours. I go to the gym, I read books all the rest of the afternoon. It's wonderful.
Boom. Dude.
Yeah, you know, like
that's
it is so fun.
Dude, I really like that you mentioned 2 to 3 hours there, because I've found after extensive research and other ways of doing it, it's like that time in the morning, a little bit of breakfast, not too much breakfast. You got to get that caffeine and you don't eat too much. Those 2 or 3 hours right then, for me, is the whole ball game. Now, I can work in the afternoon. I can. Right. And sometimes I have to. But the level of diminishing returns at that point is breathtaking. I'm working at like 15% capacity in the afternoons.
Yep.
And even if I get a workout in, even if I get a nap in, doesn't fucking matter. It's not what the morning was.
It's. You know? I think I even read social science research about this once, where it's like, because you haven't made any decisions yet in the morning, you haven't been confronted with the world, you haven't been confronted with life, your brain is just like, you know, tuned in. Like it's ready to make all the, whatever, the synapses connect. And yeah, so I'm always like a little bummed out if I miss a morning session. And so even if it's just for an hour, like honestly, I still get some of my best work done in that first hour, like when I get up, drink coffee, and just go.
Oh, man. That first hour is it. I guess that's why people used to do amphetamines all the time, because you could probably make that open up. Well, you mentioned the novella that you're working on right now. Is there anything else in the pipeline you'd like to talk to people about that you're working on and excited about?
Yeah, I mean, I have after that another novel coming, which is the glory of you know, sort of getting the 2-book deal. As you know, you have your life planned out. So I'm sort of simultaneously working on that. I'm out, you know, we have another season of Paradise. We start the writer's room in September. The new season 2 comes out in January, February, I believe. And then I'm just sort of writing some other, you know, scripts and TV ideas and film ideas. And
are they making Ohio into a series or a movie? Did I read that?
No, it remains on the internet and, you know, floating around out there. But that, you know, that it sort of went through development at HBO, didn't get over the hump, and then in their big purge of material a few years back. So it remains a possibility, but, you know, we'll have to find a way to get it restarted.
So Paradise season 2 is going to start in February, and the writer's room doesn't start till next week. That's
wild. Well, this is the season 3 writer's room.
That's already in the can. Because I was about to be very impressed.
Filmed. Yes. 2 is filmed. It's ready to go. It's going to be interesting.
I was about to say it wasn't quite South Park level of speed with the writer. No. You've read about them before, right? The way they do it.
Yes.
So. Well, dude, absolute pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for coming on. And such an honor. Thank you.
No, and I can't let you leave. I mean, first of all, I have to say, like, we were in Chicago at the same time. And I know you get people coming on. You started your own podcast, so all of us would come on and praise you, I'm sure.
That's it.
But Nation of Heat was one of those albums where I had heard about it. Like, it's sort of reputation preceded it. And then I listened to it, because I was like, whatever, I'm sure it's fine.
Yeah,
it was one of the, you know, most important albums I listened to in the 21st century. And in many ways, it was the soundtrack when I was writing Ohio and the Deluge, starting out around 2010 on both those books. And certainly like little scraps of it, you know, appear in those novels.
They appear, but I didn't know it was that foundational. Man, thank you. And yeah, that record, I don't know what it is. I didn't know what I was doing. I will be blunt in I consider that to be my best record still. I've been trying to beat it for years. I think I've gotten pretty close, but there's just something about, I don't know, it's particularly with songwriters and their first album, man. Like, if you come at that first album hard, I don't know what it is, but it's hard to get back to that place. But I'm like really at peace with that. I love that record. I still play all the songs live. I consider it to be a huge gift. The royalties that I still make off that record are, they have allowed me to continue as an artist. It's absolutely, like, I almost consider it like a divine gift to allow me to continue to work. So thank you. And I have love for that record too, man.
Yeah. And certainly the subsequent stuff, I don't want to shortchange that, but it's just like sort of your first experience with a musician where you're like, oh, who the fuck is Joe Pug? Like, what kind of name is that? Who is this person? Like, where's he from?
It's different with music like that, man. I have artists that I love. So like a debut album that I've loved in like the last 15 years would be Father John Misty's Fear Fun. Yeah. I love that record so much. And I listen to it all the time. And then I weirdly have not gone to listen to any of his stuff. And I don't know what that is. It's not like I fell in love with it so much that I'm afraid I'll like something else. It's, you know, as listeners, we sometimes you just kind of decide with an artist. Now, I would go watch a Father John Misty concert, and I have several times, but there's just something about it with music where we kind of jealously guard that first gateway into it as listeners. I don't know what it is.
100%. Well, and also you're still in that realm of like when I meet somebody else who's a Joe Pug fan, we go off to the corner of the party and talk about it for, you know, half an hour. So it's a nice spot to be.
This is why with the baseball caps I saw, it's just a bird without the name so that people can, it's kind of like a secret handshake for everyone. So, well, dude, thank you so much for being on the show.
No, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
This week's show was brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built by musicians and for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform to build a beautiful website for your music. Use promo code TWS, the initials of our podcast, TWS, to get 15% off the first year of any new subscription. Stephen Markley's books, published by Simon & Schuster, can be found at your favorite local bookstore. If before we meet again you sit down to write, please remember, an expensive drug habit is not a song, a compelling Instagram account is not a song, and most importantly, reverb is not a song. So let all that take care of itself, and for you, just keep your eye on the song.